Mr. Arnold, welcome back to the show. Had a little week hiatus there for very good reasons, but we're back. And a lot has happened over the last 2 weeks, sir.
Yeah.
A lot has happened since I woke up this morning.
Yeah, Trump, no kidding,
sending out Truth Social posts. Market's moving pretty aggressively this morning. But let's take a step back and put ourselves in your mindset, in your writer's seat. You titled the newsletter, the timestamp this week, Qui Bono, Who Benefits?
Yeah.
Benefiting from all this. What's happening here?
Yeah. I mean, it's a question that's very much on my mind, and I hope the minds of others over the last few weeks, when you've got things like the snip-snap Michael Scott approach to foreign policy and how to handle what's going on in the Persian Gulf. It's helpful to just kind of step back and try to frame it as who's actually benefiting from the different ways that things are playing out or that could play out. And, you know, I wrote about that, tried to reason through a little bit of that in the timestamp this week, standing on the shoulders of people who are much smarter than me and much better informed. Maybe we can kind of get into that. But as just a table setting comment, it really feels like, you know, the newsletter this week was just a response to, like, it feels very much if you're scrolling the timeline, if you're watching the clips on Meet the Press or someone off Fox News, you know, your options for processing all this are basically like, you know, rah, rah, we're going to destroy the most evil regime in the world and we can't let Iran have a nuclear weapon. And are you not a patriot if you don't want that to happen? You got that. And then you've got Trump is a complete moron and he alone is guiding every element of foreign policy and every decision that's being made. And he has no plan. And he's going to get us all killed. And it's World War III. And so, you know, sell everything. And there's no hope and no strategy at all going into this. And China's going to win everything as a result. You know, the U.S. will destroy its position in the world and then China will, you know, take its place. And so there's kind of like the Mark Levin approach and like the Ray Dalio approach. And that's like basically all we have been given by the mainstream press. And I feel like there's a lot more nuance at play, which I don't pretend to be smart enough to fully reason through entirely. But that's what I was trying to maybe think through a little bit in the newsletter this week.
Yeah. No, I recorded with Tom Luongo late Friday night, too. I think that's a little bit more in the middle. He's got a very specific theory that we're not going to dive into here. If you want to listen to that, you can go to TFTC and get it. But no, I think fog of war, and I've consistently had to remind myself of this over the last 3-4 weeks, is try not to make any shoot from the hip decisions or react too emotionally to the headlines, the pundit talking points or the Truth Social posts that come out, because we're truly in the fog of war. And speaking of Truth Social, I think just to make sure we're staying on the task of the show, which is topical news, to fill you all in on how we're reading this. I mean, we have Truth Social post from Saturday and then early this morning. Many people are calling this a taco and an attempt to basically suppress interest rate yields and the price of oil, so that markets don't go too haywire. But essentially, going into the weekend, Trump said that Iran had 48 hours to open the strait or there would be some massive hits on their power infrastructure. And then early this morning, Trump came out and said there was productive talks, both directly and indirectly, with the Iranian regime over the weekend. Markets screamed, Bitcoin screamed above 71,000. It's still holding over that level right now. Oil fell below, WTI fell below $90 a barrel. And then Iran came out rather quickly and said, hey, these talks did not happen. So what is your reading on this?
Yeah. I mean, my only reading is that there is no reading, right? Like I led off with this because fog of war is exactly the right way to think about it. And like, you'll see people on both sides of that kind of general bifurcation that I laid out. It's like, you know, when Trump says something that's totally credible and should be completely believed, and when Iran says something, they're just lying. Or when China comments on something, they're just, you know, lying or trying to manipulate or using propaganda tactics or whatever. And there are other people who think the exact opposite, right? Like, and anything Iran says is totally correct and accurate, and they're the ones telling the truth, and Trump is just making everything up. And I think we should all just be in the mode of everyone is, if you pardon my French, bullshitting right now. It is totally to everyone's advantage in all elements of this conflict to create as much uncertainty and obfuscation as possible. So that should, to your point on asterisks, leave everyone with a lot of humility on what's actually happening. And yeah, I guess I would just say, let's try to be equally skeptical of the various posts and media reports coming out of all the different sides of this conflict. But that, you know, so that just frames everything up. The one thing that is maybe less, maybe a good place to dig into like the meat of the newsletter is actually like a more objective data point, is just the spread between WTI and Brent, Brent crude. You mentioned WTI went below 90. I haven't checked Brent this morning, so I don't know where exactly the spread's shaking out today as of Trump's semi-taco or not taco, depending on how you think about it. But to me, this was kind of the story of the week as it relates to trying to parse through what's going on and what the actual goals are and constraints are. This, you know, pretty remarkable move, which, you know, may or may not be sustained. But I think everyone got a good reminder last week that, you know, it's easy to forget in times of relative tranquility and especially like world is flat globalization. But oil is not like a globally homogenous market. It commands different prices in different places for different grades and different benchmarks. There are people, again, who are, you know, way smarter and more in the weeds on all the nuances of the global oil market than you or I. But this is just kind of a good summary chart to show that kind of violent reminder that we got. So, you know, WTI is a US-based benchmark, mostly for consumption here domestically. Brent is mostly a benchmark for Europe, Middle East, and Asia. And, you know, unsurprisingly, like the places where supply has been much more disrupted is starting to show, you know, a much greater price spike. I mean, if you flip to the next slide, you can see that even more clearly with the prices in the Persian Gulf, right? So the places where that are most disrupted are just like blowing out even beyond where Brent is. And I think that's interesting because as you parse through like to the extent that there maybe were a plan, if you, you know, entertain that argument from the United States side, if there were a plan, you'd probably be interested in leveraging one of the US's key advantages, which is being an energy independent net oil exporter. You know, we are currently all sitting here experiencing more pain at the pump than I think we would like. But at the same time, supply in the US is not really meaningfully at risk today, whereas there are a lot of parts of the world where that's not the case, where they're net oil importers and they have to source a ton of oil through places like the Gulf Coast, through the Strait of Hormuz. And, you know, it certainly applies to what's oil and LNG, so natural gas as well. Certainly a big issue for Europe, as we saw a few years ago with the Russia-Ukraine debacle. And it's a huge source we've talked about on the show before for China and the other East Asian countries, you know, allies as well, Japan, Korea, Taiwan. But I think that spread is an interesting data point for thinking through if you were in the driver's seat at the Pentagon, if you were writing the national security strategy that we've talked about in here before, when you were kind of sizing up what are the US's advantages that we can push on, what are the buttons we could push, you know, probably the first one you would think of is the base energy input to the entire global economy, especially when several of the parties that you consider to be your adversaries or your rivals do not have the energy independence that you do, right? And they can be made to kind of, you know, be put over a barrel a little bit, depending on what happens in the Middle East in a way that you don't necessarily have to deal with. So to me, this is like, as you're reasoning through what might be going on, what might the administration be looking for and like trying to do, to the extent that you want to entertain the notion that there is a plan, I think this was a big, you know, flashing red signal for, you know, one of the key kind of asymmetries and relative leverage points that most likely the US is probably thinking about. And if so, I think that has implications for how anyone should think about, you know, what's going to happen, you know, from here.
Yeah. Just to give an update, because the spreads have changed, at least the spot spreads. So if we're looking now, Brent's down around 9% today at 102.28 as I speak. WTI, as you can see over here, is under 90 at 89.30 cents. So we've got like a $13 spread here. So the spread, at least on the spot prices, has compressed. I'm sure it's similar to that 1 month spread that we had in the chart above, but this is all, again, subject to change on a whim, on a Truth Social post. So be aware there, but here's where we're trading now. A lot of volatility in the market. And that's, again, going back to the fog of war and trying to discern, I think these pricing signals are probably where we're going to get the most signal is in these markets. And you can decide whether or not you want to listen to the pundits and listen to the politicians involved. I think markets are going to give you the clearest signal. And I think the volatility that we've experienced over the last 3 weeks, and more specifically over the last week with weekend Truth Social posts, with aftermarket hour sort of negotiations, whatever it may be, or tax, I think the volatility in the market is just pricing in this uncertainty. And so I think the signal that we're getting is, despite any certainty that politicians or administration members may be posturing publicly, I think markets are still out there saying we have no idea exactly how this ends. And I think one thing that we may have more clarity on than anything else is just long-term ramifications of the destruction to the energy infrastructure in the Middle East and what they may have on markets in the long term. And I think here's a signal here. Iran, the attack wiped out 70% of Qatar's LNG capacity for up to 5 years. Qatar Energy CEO says, reported by Reuters, I believe there was a five-year force majeure on some government contracts Qatar had with trading partners. And so it seems clear at this point that a lot of critical refinery infrastructure has been materially impacted by the war in the Middle East right now. And I think this is one thing that markets are beginning to price in, is what is the long-term ramifications of this disruption to the supply chain, and how do we reorient the energy industry based off of the destruction of this infrastructure?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think this is one of the more sobering headlines from last week that I think people are just now, you know, still trying to process, that even if the conflict ended tomorrow and today and there were no more attacks on, you know, different elements of Gulf energy infrastructure, refining infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, et cetera, you know, you've already got now like a long tail of multiple years, perhaps up to 5 years, right? As Qatar is saying, disruption to significant elements of a significant percentage of production out of the region, right? So that there's going to be a lengthy cost impact to that. There's going to be a lengthy supply disruption impact to that. Again, even if Trump is right and we're going to get a deal very, very soon. And, you know, I think that, again, you ask the question like, well, who does that help? Who does that hurt the most? Structurally, like, I think you tend to think that would hurt the, you know, Europe, Middle East and Asian countries the most. And, you know, it's not something that can be ameliorated if that, you know, if headlines like that, if statements like that are not just, you know, being sensational, you know, if that's actually accurate, which we don't have any reason to believe it's not directionally, that's a structural problem that doesn't get ameliorated whenever Trump decides that he wants to, you know, sign a deal or taco or whatever you want to call it. Right. And I think, you know, that leads into this piece that was written by Anas Al-Haji early. It was posted early today, but it, you know, synthesizes some of his thoughts from the last couple of weeks. Highly recommend giving him a follow and just checking out the link there to the Substack, where he summarizes all this, but just kind of walks through like the relative leverage that either side has and kind of the asymmetry of the impact of all the disruption in the Strait of Hormuz and in the Gulf. And we won't read it all here. I really recommend everyone, you know, go check it out. But he's positing that in a somewhat counter consensus way that I think has not really shown up in most mainstream discussions, that Iran does not really have the capacity or the interest or the incentive to close the Strait of Hormuz, and that a lot of the headlines that suggest that there's a blockade effectively, or that no ships can get through, or that they're, you know, attacking a bunch of different tankers, are, you know, overdone and maybe missing key context, and that it's not even totally clear to hear him tell it exactly who's responsible for different threats that have been made to different ships and shippers and insurers. So, you know, anonymous threats from unidentified sources, you know, could easily be coming from any different side. And, you know, he's positing as a result that the U.S. does have potentially significant interest in being the driver here of keeping the Strait disrupted and then engaging in the Kabuki theater to suggest to make it seem like, you know, it's not actually our fault and it's being orchestrated by somebody else. Obviously, Iran is still attacking, or seems to be attacking, fog of war asterisk again, but there's still attacks on infrastructure around the Gulf, which may or may not, you know, be fully workable within this framework. But I just think like that kind of thinking is, you know, it's a 0% on the nodes of the, you know, the decision tree that people are thinking through right now, mostly in the market. And I think it's, if you look through the incentives, you look through the capacities on different sides, you look through what the U.S. has explicitly said about the national security strategy and how the Strait of Hormuz aligns with the Panama Canal and Red Sea routes and the Greenland and shipping routes that, you know, might be controlled or influenced by that, and everything about that Trump has said about wanting to exert more dominance of trade flows and, you know, reposition the U.S. as a true industrial powerhouse again, it all kind of neatly lines up with what you're seeing in the Strait of Hormuz. So I just think, you know, maybe that shouldn't even be your base case, but it should be more than a 0% chance, right? It should be, call it 20%, 25%, whatever. And if that's the case, then you start to have to entertain a lot of other downstream impacts and thoughts on how the U.S. might actually be able to pull off, you know, the triple Lindy that they may actually be looking to, you know, to do here.
We were sharing another piece of Anas analysis last week, And I think there was one thing in that particular analysis that really said, oh, this is something I didn't realize, that the market is completely misreading. This was Chinese tankers making it through the Strait of Hormuz. And people were saying, well, Iran is basically picking Chinese oil tankers and saying, you guys can go through, we'll settle in yuan. But Anas highlighted, well, the reason that these Chinese ships are making it through the Straits because they have Chinese insurance, and Lloyd's of London dropped the insurance of every other oil tanker moving through the Strait. And so if you're not insured, you're not going to move because the risk is too high. Whereas the Chinese ships are using Chinese insurance. And so they feel that they're able to move through the Strait relatively, not risk-free, but they're hedged with insurance. And so that was a signal there, like, oh, maybe there is something here. And then to add to that and to put a point in this is geopolitical 4D chess that is working in Trump's favor. There was a deal between the US and Japan to deliver oil from Alaska to Japan. And so sort of that shift of demand for US oil over oil in the Gulf. That's another point in that direction. So fog of war, trying to read through the lines here. Those are two things that stuck out to me last week as well. But speaking of China, and the idea that this is basically a proxy war to assert dominance and shift demand from other parts of the supply chain towards the United States. I think there's some interesting reactions from China's economy to this that show it does have some relative strength and leverage in this game.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's you kind of read this one either way, right? Like the chatter on, you know, some of the Anas Al-Haji type points that you would see over the last couple weeks on Twitter and elsewhere is like, okay, well, even if that's right, you know, China will just hit back by, you know, playing the rare earths game and not shipping other critical goods to the US. And I think it's interesting because, like, that's definitely possible. At the same time, you know, you're seeing already last year and then this year, this Reuters headline pointing out, you know, massive growth in Chinese exports, particularly into, and a lot of this is going, especially into Europe, kind of diverting away from the US, although US exports are still growing significantly. But I think, like, it's an interesting east-west interweaving where it takes two to tango here. And yeah, China could curb exports dramatically, but the fact that, you know, they need to grow exports so dramatically over the last year, and especially again into places like Europe, which you have to think there's going to be eventually a downstream political impact to that as Europe's existing industrial base gets further and further hollowed out by things like that. But I think that's telling you, like, this is the model for China, right? It is an industrial powerhouse that needs to keep shipping and producing and having the world buy its goods and running this massive finished goods trade surplus. And, you know, that gives them a choke point on a lot of goods. But the flip side is, like, just deciding to effectively boycott, you know, huge parts of the world as a means of, you know, cutting off, say, the US and US allies from, you know, finished goods that they provide eventually becomes cutting off your nose to spite your face. They've got a massive issue with real estate. They've got banks. They've got a ton of effectively zombie banks. You can go look at great work from Alex Campbell. I think he's AB Campbell on Twitter, who's done a ton of deep analysis on the state of Chinese banks. The consumer is still, you know, far weaker than I think they would like, the domestic consumer. So saying that you're going to, you know, undercut the entire driver of, you know, the country's economic model as a means of retaliating against the US is, like, yeah, it's possible. But again, it just comes back to a question of, well, who's going to blink first, right? Who has, in this relative leverage game, like, who has more leverage, who has more time to kind of sit and wait? And you could argue, in many ways, China does because of that manufacturing base. And you could also, I think, argue on the other side that they can't necessarily afford to, you know, slow that down dramatically as a means of, you know, hitting back against, you know, what the US is doing, you know, especially with, to the extent that we continue to, that oil continues to do what it's doing, especially asymmetrically impacting Asia, you know, you're getting squeezed on both sides there if you start to compress the revenue base and also get hit on the cost side. So yeah, I think it's just, it's not clear to me that either side here has the clear, like, knockout punch, and we're very much like these Siamese twins. Like, it's not that easy to, like, just separate either one. It's going to hurt both, right? Maybe that leads then into to take the other side of it, you know, the yield story, right, for the US and other Western governments.
Yeah, I mean, talking about signal and markets, I think many people are surmising that Trump sent out that tweet this morning because he was looking at the 2-year yield going over 4%, and there are people behind the scenes saying this is getting rather chaotic. The financial system cannot sustain rates at this elevated level for too long. And again, fog of war, who knows exactly why he sent the tweet, but many people are are saying he's looking at the yield curve and noticing it's getting a bit out of whack. And here we have the U.S. 10-year, which is back to levels not seen since early August of last year.
Yeah. And, you know, we're still in a range that's like reasonably manageable historically. You know, it's around, we're not breaking out to, you know, multi-year highs or, you know, breaking out of like this, this recent channel over the last year or two. But you can see where, you know, the bigger picture is probably that I probably should have put on here as well is the MOVE index, which is the Treasury volatility index that measures the volatility of these yields. And that printed 109 on Friday night, which was the highest level since Liberation Day. So it's not even just a level, but it's also the direction of travel and the speed of that direction. And so I think that's clearly like on everyone's mind. And that this is like our Achilles heel, right? The debt situation is not, yeah, here you go. Here's the MOVE. This isn't 1975 anymore. Debt to GDP is, you know, not 30%. It's 125%. You know, we have, as we've talked about on the show before, an interest expense coming out of the federal government that is growing swiftly. And when you look at interest plus fixed entitlement payments plus military budget, which we learned last week is going to grow by another $200 billion unplanned to fight this war, veterans benefits, et cetera, basically more or less fixed expenses. We're already kind of roughly on 100% of tax receipts. And so, you know, we can't really afford to be rolling debt at much higher than, you know, call it a blended rate of like 4%. So like this is, as it relates to relative leverage for the rest of the world. Yeah, this is the key point to watch, and keeping this in check is going to be, you know, you have to think one of the main constraints that the U.S. has. And then it's even, you know, you bring up here like the German and French 10-year bonds going back to levels not seen since in France's case, basically 08, and Germany back to the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis in 2011. So this is actually like much more notable in terms of, you know, historical ranges and really breaking out. And, you know, I think it's kind of like the classic, the U.S. sneezes and the rest of the world gets a cold, you know, just like with kind of the oil and gas story we talked about. You know, we're uncomfortable with the current, the yield levels that we just talked about at kind of 4 or 4.5%. But you're quickly, you know, ripping to levels that are, you know, much more historically notable for countries that are going to, like Germany, France, and the rest of the European complex, that are going to be hit much harder by, you know, the spike in say Brent crude that we talked about, or the lack of availability of Qatari LNG. So this is for the West broadly construed, for kind of the U.S. nexus. We can debate whether whether Europe is in the U.S. nexus anymore or not, but this is the constraint to watch kind of on our side.
Yeah, I mean, this would validate the theory that Trump's trying to break free from the World Economic Forum Davos class. And I guess this is very Luongo coded, where we're trying to deflate the euro dollar market and bring control of our interest rates and control over the dark dollar pools back to the United States. And to do that, you would need to essentially decimate European economies and their financial system. And this seems like the war in the Gulf right now is certainly putting a lot of stress on European treasury markets. And so with that, we have a couple more slides we could go through, but I'm going to pick one. Everybody's talking about the Fed. I think as it pertains to what we focus on, Bitcoin, hard assets, neutral reserve assets in the digital age, we do have some signal out of the gold markets throughout all this chaos. And I think it highlights that gold is actually being used as a just true reserve asset in these times. Many people are expecting gold to skyrocket. We were talking before we hit record. I didn't even realize it hit right around $4,000 earlier today. I guess it wicked down to about 4,000, currently sitting at $4,469. But many people are saying, hey, isn't this supposed to be a flight to safety? But it seems like, particularly in the Middle East, as all this infrastructure is getting blown up, you know, you have people leaving these countries. Real estate in Dubai is down something like 40 to 60%, depending on what index you look at to track that. And it seems like these countries are needing to tap into gold reserves to actually tap into liquidity to put cement in some of these holes that are emerging.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's a funny, crazy move that I think is probably not what a lot of people would have expected on a knee-jerk basis. But, you know, it's yet another iteration of, you know, in a crisis, you sell what you can, not what you want. But I think it's also, and to be fair, also like gold is probably overdone, big, massive recent move. And this is just an ugly chart. So probably due for, you know, a puke on just on that basis. But I think it's interesting because if you flip down one slide, it's showing you, I think, the beginnings of gold actually becoming more relevant again as a reserve asset to absorb trade surpluses. And it's kind of exactly, Michael McNair makes this point that it's kind of exactly what you would expect when these massive trade surplus economies in the Gulf kind of have, see their trade surpluses temporarily shrink to zero, right? When top line goes to zero and the bills still need to be paid across the country, you know, the place you can tap into is the neutral reserve asset. But you can only do that if you've been building reserves of that asset to absorb prior trade surpluses, right? So I think this is kind of an unwind. This unwind is telling you that something has been happening over, you know, the last few years, the last decade. We've kind of known this anyway. If you look at just sovereign gold buying, right? If you look at most sovereigns kind of on net, not, you know, no longer buying treasuries as of, I think, 2015. Clearly, there's been, you know, a big move and an accelerating move in the last couple of years, especially since Liberation Day, into gold to absorb trade surpluses. And so it's counterintuitively kind of like exactly the move you would expect to see if that were happening, right? If you had a bunch of people or a bunch of countries that needed to move into gold to as a flight out of other things, then yeah, you'd see, you know, a bid or at least a sustained price in this kind of environment. But this big sell-off thing is telling you there are big trade surplus actors out there that need to tap into this because they need something to sell to cover, you know, expenses and keep the lights on. So that, I think, is to get to tie everything back to what we do here with Bitcoin. I think fundamentally, this is actually on a longer run basis, a medium term basis, pretty bullish for the hard assets as absorber of trade surplus thesis. As gold, you know, fulfills that role more and more, which I frankly, you know, expect it to over the next 5 years, 10 years, this sell-off notwithstanding, that's just opening up a bigger and bigger market for neutral sovereign assets that can serve as that kind of absorption. And I think that only just primes the pump further and further for eventually meaningful actors around the world to understand and act on Bitcoin's relative value proposition relative to gold.
Yes. And we'll end it with this. And again, fog of war before I share the screen and show the tweet. I think this is a newly appointed part of the Iranian regime as they're trying to re-architect their administration or their high levels of power as the war decimates the IRGC. And he came out and tweeted last night, I believe, alongside military bases, those financial entities that finance the U.S. military budget are legitimate targets. U.S. Treasury bonds are soaked in Iranians' blood. Purchase them and you purchase a strike on your HQ and assets. We monitor your portfolios. This is your final notice. And so obviously some very, very strong rhetoric here from MB Golubev. But I think it highlights that whether or not people truly react to this specifically, I think it does highlight some truths where the global reserve asset of the world being U.S. Treasuries does come with increased political risk, especially today. And there's the case for a neutral reserve asset, whether it be gold or Bitcoin, is only getting stronger by the minute here as this war continues to wage on.
Cosign, once again.
We'll be back next week.